Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
the 7th podcast of Chasing the Sun by Richard Cohen, the epic story of the star that gives us life. And we're on to part two. Part one was about the various mythologies going up to people believing the terrors of the sky. Bit of a garbled story so far because a little bit's to do with human history, a little bit's to do with a confused understanding of science. Now, if you want to talk about the sun, science really talks about light and the various phenomena which have come from explaining the sun, so it's rather extraordinary. But here we'll find out what part two is about. It's called Discovering the Sun, and there is a picture of just this amazing picture. Let's read it to you. So there's this man with a large phallus and this, what looks like the sun star hanging off the end of the phallus. Bronze Age petroglyphs, which is rock carvings from all over the world, connect the sun with Kunduzi, as in the drawing from the Kamoka Valley in the Central Alps in North Italy. The male figure with a solid disc attached to his phallus. One would think maybe or maybe not that these things are very hard to interpret. So it definitely looks like a phallus and a solar disc associated with it. Okay, chapter 5, the first astronomers. Okay, this is a quote from 1865, Ralph Waldo Emerson. I'm now beginning to learn to read these things in reverse. So he said, "Of all tools, an observatory is the most sublime. What is so good in a college as an observatory? Sublime attaches to the door and to the first stair you ascend, and this is the road to the stars." I think that's beautiful. It's also really, to think about it, is that obviously the stars are little points of light. Everything else is really an exercise in lateral thinking, and it's interesting, people's interest in stars wane. It's an invitation for lateral thinking, and people feel very nervous about it. This next one is Flaubert, Gustave Flaubert, from 1870. Astronomy, a fine science, useful only to sailors, while on the subject, laugh at astrology. Okay, there you go. In 1849, Sir Norman Lockyer, that's the famous scientist, one of Britain's foremost living scientists, the man who discovered helium in the sun before it was known on Earth, published The Dawn of Astronomy, in which he broke down the work of his ancient predecessors into three distinct phases. Civilizations first went through a period of worship, where celestial phenomena were construed only as the actions, moons, and warning from the gods. Next, people began putting astronomy into practical uses, such as agricultural navigation, and finally, the heavens were studied solely for the pleasure of the purpose of pure knowledge. Through Lockyer's divisions are seen now as too schematic, for instance. We may question whether reverential stage was ever completely outgrown, or his definition of the third stage ignores the sense of wonder that often drives astronomers. His categories still offer a useful yardstick. Okay, just let me remember what his second category is. Putting it to practical uses. I think this person is a bit confused in what he said. I think it's the... his third stage, basically single stage. Long before mankind gathered into cities, there was astronomy, or at least there were people studying the sun. We have evidence of observatories in several parts of the ancient world. However, one city above all others deserves to be called the birthplace of organized recorded science of astronomy, Babylon. And I couldn't agree with you more. So the big question is, why is this the first time we've heard of Babylon in your discussions? The country was settled by a people of unknown origin between the Tigris and Euphrates River in what is now the heart of modern Iraq, the Fertile Crescent, I think it's called. The surrounding land was called Sumer, although another name for this fertile flat area was Eden. Sumerians began farming about 9000 BC. Roughly 250 years later, they invented the wheel, cart, plough transforming every aspect of life from travel and transport to warfare and industry. I don't know, I think it's the wheel came, I believe, from Northern Europe, from the Beaker culture. Let's see. These crucial steps in freeing some people to become full-time priests, scholars and merchants. Around 3100 BC, they invented a system of writing that incorporated astronomical concepts into two of its characters, one representing a star, the other the sun over the horizon. By 2350 BC, the Sumerians had been subdued by their neighbours to the north, but it was the conquerors who were transformed. Sumerian remained the language of the region, and scholarship, divining the future culture by observing the stars, became a preeminent intellectual discipline. At first, the sun was cast as subordinate to the moon and worshipped in only two minor cities, Larsa and Sippar. By 1800 BC, we're getting really close to the Greek civilization. The growing metropolis of Babylon, now 70 miles south of present-day Baghdad, taking its modern name from the Greek rendering of Akkadian, Babylonian, gates of God, had become a preeminent in the religion, ruled by the Amorite king Hammurabi. He's the first person who produced a set of laws, I do remember, who encouraged the careful recording of movements of the stars. The Babylonians believed the sun and to be the baleful divinity that spied for the high gods and was unforgiving judge of mankind. The precursor of future images of Jewish and Christian God, the sun depicted as an old man with a long beard, beams radiating from between his shoulders. His figures overtook the moon in importance and metamorphized into the sun royal, exercising attributes of earthly divinity and kingship. I'm just really trying to think. We've got lots of evidence of what the Babylonian beliefs were, because they were subsumed as into Greek theology, particularly by Parmenides. The next to subjugate the land around 750 BC were the Assyrians, getting very close to Pythagoras, whose kings called themselves sons, S-U-N-S, of the world, during their campaigns of conquest, in which they would line the walls of each fallen city with the skins of its inhabitants. Babylon sank into political and economic decay. Eventually, a series of revolts culminated in the Assyrians' overthrow in 606 BC. Well, Pythagoras is up and running by now. And though the new masters, Kalidi or Chaldeans, a loose federation of tribes of the West Semitic region from among the southern swamps and coastal plains, held sway for the briefest of ascendancies in Mesopotamian history. The king, Nebuchadnezzar, who ruled from 605 to 562 BC, overseas saw a renaissance that returned Babylon to the cultural center of a massive empire. The position of astronomy was assured, especially in schools flourished not only in Babylon, but also in the large towns. Exchanges of ideas among the Persians, Jews, and Greeks living in the same cities were eased by a lingua franca, written in simple characters of Aramaic. So lingua franca is like the English nowadays, a universal thing. And so they produced a lot of things. Initially, the Chaldeans, their name now but synonymous with the Babylonians, were content simply to watch the skies, but around 550 BC, they felt curious and confident enough to apply mathematical techniques to their records. While dividing the heavens into zones, the most important being what we now know as the celestial equator, in later years it would be identified as the path of the Earth's ecliptic journey, along which they connected the zodiac, from the Greek zodion, living creatures. So the zodiac is, you know, quite rightfully, a Babylonian creation. It's amazing. A diagrammatic representation of the great figures that they imagined to be making the sun's movements. The following mnemonic lists them in order, starting from the vernal equinox in March. So the vernal equinox for us would be the autumn, but for you in Northern Hemisphere, that's the summer. The ram, the bull, the heavenly twins, and next the crab and lion shines, the virgin and the scales, scorpion, archer, and he goat, the man who bears the watering pot, and the fish with the glittering tails. The chair and its advances were made amid great upheavals. Around 689 BC, the Babylon had been destroyed by the Assyrian king Shinashrib. The city had been rebuilt in even greater splendor, according to Herodotus. Its walls, 56 miles in circumference and 335 feet high. So that's pretty ridiculously high, but collapsed once more under the onslaught of the Medes and Persians to be absorbed in the empire of Cyrus the Great. By the C-Y-R-U-S, the Great. By the time the... Hopefully, I'll suddenly hit an improved zone here reading. Chaldeans were overthrown in 5, this is getting perilously close, but the Greeks are up and running around this time. They'd become famous for their expertise in studying the stars. According to the Greek academic Strabo of Amicia, 64 BC to AD 23, a special district of the kingdom was set apart for local philosophers. The Chaldeans, as they were called, were concerned mainly with astronomy, but some of these, who were not approved by the others, professed to be writers of horoscopes. While most of what they recorded was purely descriptive, astrology became the business of interpreting the heavens, not for ordinary individuals, but for king and country. Several branches of pseudoscience grew up, the first and most important being the art of foretelling the subject's life from the position of the stars, as well as from the sun, at their birth or conception. Chaldeans would draw on astronomical information to predict human destinies, work out the certain planets were in the sky at the child's birth, and from these circumstances draw conclusions. Some aspects of the star's influence were obvious. For example, the sun's position on the ecliptic was tied to the seasons. If the heavens could tell you the most propitious times for planting and harvesting, why shouldn't they also indicate the best times to marry or to undertake an unavoidable but dangerous journey? Understandably, astrologers took to drawing such conclusions about the influences of the celestial bodies, even if these were without scientific basis. Yet, without, which it had to do, you used to say they just had no idea of science. They had no idea of logic. If you read through their stuff, they could be easily upended by superstition. It's just so amazing. If you read along, going well, and then superstition takes the reading. Okay, yet without the promptings of astrology, naked eye astronomy would never have reached so deeply. So it's interesting that astrology is what really got us into it. And that's a really good point. At first, there was no division between the disciplines. One practiced astronomy for the purpose of astrology. It was a fruitful partnership. By the 5th century BC, astronomers had established a year ahead the expected intervals between sunrise and sunset for various days. Monthly apparent movements of the sun and much else. They developed the arithmetic required to predict the motions of the moon and planets, and from there constructed the calendar. Even more important was the discovery of a system to predict the passage of the moon and the sun, enabling the forecast of eclipse. The Chaldeans maintained highly accurate and detailed records, but frustratingly, we lack any explanations for how they constructed their tables. They made their observations from step pyramids called ziggurats, which were attached to temples, often the size of a fortress, and painted in 7 colours of the rainbow. The Tower of Babel, portrayed in the Bible, has vainglorious attempts to build a stairway to the stars. It is the best known, but the most commanding of all Babylon was another ziggurat who rose over 400 feet in 7 gleaming enameled levels. His zenith crowned with a shrine that held a table of solid gold, an ornate bed on which each night some young woman awaited the pleasure of the god for his more assiduous earthly or his more assiduous earthly representative. Oh dear, there you go. Well, I didn't know that about the Plato's the Tower of Babel. Well, much has been made of the climate allegedly perfect for observation. Plato lauded Mesopotamia's cloudless atmosphere, and Herodotus wrote that the air in the region is constantly clear, the country is warm through the absence of cold winds. This was likely based on the third-hand accounts. Sandstorms and mirages would have been serious obstructions to the following phenomena close to the following kilometers close to the horizon. Even in the best conditions, it was not easy to distinguish between a planet and a fixed star when gazing on the myriad of points in the heavens. Now, one of the things is that once you get used to it, planets don't twinkle because they're slightly bigger, whereas stars twinkle, so you can spot a planet, just sort of drops out to what the planet is. Observation by itself then was not enough. The Chaldeans began to, so these are indeed the first astronomers, I'm glad he's got back to Babylon, analyze and interpret what they had seen, writing their commentaries in journals, almanacs and star catalogues. By conservative estimate, they recorded 373 solar and 832 lunar eclipses during their brief dominance. A wide range of daily happenings, meteorological events, river levels, fires ravaging the cities, deaths of kings, epidemics, thefts, conquests, plagues of locusts, famines, and, of particular importance, fluctuations in the prices of barley, dates, pepper, cress, sesame, and wool, always in that order, were scrupulously transcribed into clay tablets. That's interesting. The Chaldeans also, sort of like the ASX 500, okay. The Chaldeans also inscribed their calculations of planetary positions on tablets that in AD 709, the Greek writer Heliodorus would name ephemerides, means matter specific to the day. In effect, working journals showing the consecutive appearance of the same objects in the sky. About 70 tablets from the main series survive, and of the 7,000 notations, fully a quarter involve the sun. Divination, observation, calculations in Babylon, anyone could read, study mathematics. The average school child knew far more about the heavens than do most of us today, and I would tell you that over and over, that we are getting less and less ignorant people, simply because people have got a lot of screen time. If it's not moving, their interest just drifts pretty quickly, or they are quick to rubbish you. If they can't see it and they can't do it, it's your rubbish, because they're used to the screens. Okay. Who rarely examined the skies. In the age far removed from our modern benefits of gas and electricity, the lights of the heavens had no competition, so that a horseman did not carry bands or trapers at night, but rode under the light of the stars. Yet for all its accomplishments, the organized astronomy remained an elitist activity. A college might contain just two or three people genuinely taken up by the heavens, and these were hampered, as astronomers are to this day, by the limits of their technology. One powerful mathematical tool gave Babylon much of its mystique in the sciences. The place value numeral system. Yeah. So this is, when I say 1234, I'll write that down, it's got a place. Now, the interesting thing is that we have just moved each tweak a little bit further. The Americans have introduced a little space between the thousands. There were two versions, one that used a decimal base and the method of the day-to-day business of calculating lunar cycles, and the other used a base 60 for measuring solar cycles. The latter, although more cumbersome, would be employed by various societies for two millennia up until Copernicus, and from it sprang the division of degrees 60 minutes and minutes into 60 seconds, or it's actually second minute. Such a method was far superior to any in the ancient world, and is curiously close to the that of a modern computer. Explanation. In 1790s, during the French Revolution, a radical French mathematician attempted to grade the circle by dividing each quadrant into 100 parts, then decimally subdivided. But the system never caught on. Less scientifically, but more enduringly, the French word for 80, 420, survives as a remainder of our ancestral counters in toes on fingers. Oh, okay, I understand that. Babylonian mathematics has set decimal arithmetic algebraic operations, geometric rules spread over far greater area than their astronomy ever reached. Indeed, preceded systematic astronomy by more than a millennium. But major shortcomings remained. The early mathematical observers treated time not as a measure, but almost as a quality. Nor were they interested in quantifying space. There was no concept of absolute distance. No trace appears in Babylonian astronomy of any desire to construct a comprehensive scheme to account for all heavenly phenomena, to investigate their nature and causes, or take a synoptic view of the universe as a whole. The Babylonians had their lunar calendar and were the first to divide the day into 12 halves. Okay, which is the sexagesimal. 12 halves. Into two 12-part halves. And it's interesting that 0 to 6 o'clock was defined as sunrise, and so the length of hours varied as the length of days. The shortcoming in turn hampered attempts to work out the shape of the Earth. They never learned that it was roughly spherical. The Gormand, as its simplest, a vertical stick whose shadow is used to tell the time, was beyond them. Not the least because they had no concept of north, south, east, west, or cardinal points. Anything approaching compass-like clarity had to wait for the third quarter of the 4th century BC. They had not even established the sequence of planets outwards from the sun, but then no one knew any better. The Babylonian astronomy was, as its current high reputation may be due to the fact that so many Greek records have perished. Clay lasted better. Yeah, well, it's a bit biased, personally. However, overall, I share Noel's Sedrill's view, quote, the complete development of this science took hundreds of years to show how difficult it was. Far more difficult than any other science in ancient world, but because of its magnitude and complexity of the subject, and because it was the first empirical science. Oh, okay. Around 330 BC, the region fell under Alexander, on whose early death his marshes of Seleucus took over the greater part of the conquered lands. Marshal Seleucus. So Alexander did die eventually of malaria. 60 years later, the mighty dynastist Antoninus I forcefully moved most of the city's inhabitants to a newly founded metropolis of Seleucia, 60 miles to the north, which is Baghdad. For the astrologers of the old city, this was an indignity too far. They kept up their practices in the Temple of Bel, almost at the end of the first Christian century. But theirs was a dying grass. Thus ended, writes James McEnvoy, 2,000-year Babylonian cultural development of watching the heavens. Okay, so the bloody Greeks again. Even before Babylon was relocated into Baghdad, its learning had spread to Egypt, Greece, and Rome, and to the west, to India, possibly as far as China to the east. The Egyptians adopted the Babylonian zodiac while rejecting their worldview. With this emphasis, importance and faithful predictions in the universe as bad news. Herodotus refers to Egypt as a gift of the river, possibly the Nile's annual flood, and the cycle ideal for growing crops encouraged a sense of well-being. The priest astrologers knew that the Nile would overflow its bank around the summer solstice, when the bright Sirius rises and would make their calendrical predictions accordingly. From the beginning, the Nile's yearly flooding yielded an unexpected benefit, as the government's main source of income was land tax. There was a constant need to re-establish the boundaries and settle disputes caused by the floods, giving rise early on in Egypt's history to a cadre of skilled surveyors. Geometry, the pure mathematics of points and lines, curves, taken the name of the Greek word for surveying. G means measure. Algebra, on the other hand, derives from the Arab word meaning compulsion, compelling the unknown X to assume numerical value. A more colourful notion advanced by some historians is that algebra means putting back into its proper place or bone setting. The bone setter, donk, is known as an algebrister, whether because he resets or because he compels Cervantes never makes it a clear. Okay, the Egyptians are exceptionally practical people, even if they remain 95% illiterate. They had invented writing slightly ahead of the Babylonians around 3200 BC, devised sophisticated ways for measuring that would eventually be joined to their building skills to create the pyramids. Oh dear. But this was only one of the many advances. They tried various ways, for instance, to gauge the sun's diameter using gonons, water clocks, and even horses. In the last instance, the horse would be galloped across level ground from the moment the sun's upper edge appeared on the horizon until the entire disc wasn't clear above it, a period of approximately 2 months, in which the animal was reckoned to be to cover 10 stadia, a term of corruption of Egyptians for the word racehorse. And it was inferred that the motion of the sun must equal to that of the horse, and the diameter must be 10 stadia too. Now this was hardly good geometry. It's amazing. Okay. Amazing. The Egyptians had their own mathematical system at least as early as 2800 BC, but it was crude, and unlike the Babylonians, they never progressed beyond basic arithmetic, although they did manipulate this to produce both multiplication and division. With the exception of two-thirds, the only fractions they used were the form of 11th. Although the mathematical papyri from around 800 to 1600 BC bring off some fairly sophisticated calculations such as the volume of a truncated pyramid, their geometry could not transact complex computations, nor could they manage the type of calculation necessary to progress the observation to prediction. That's 111 is, this is a magical fraction which has appeared many, many times. So the Saxons has 11. The cricket has 11. 11 is an interesting base system. There is no evidence that they understood the concept of latitude or ever recorded eclipses with any regularity. What did emerge in the intricate development of their religion and the pronouncement of their priests, astrologers, was a canon of times to be especially careful. And while they derived few predictions from what they saw, they did map the stars, planets, and constellations and record their movements. Their understandings of what astronomy could accomplish might be summed up by the inscription on the pedestal of the statue of the... Go on. Astronomer Harkhebi, which dates from the early 3rd century BC. While it tells us little about the man, it does describe his duties. He was to determine the rising settings of the constellations of the zodiac, to establish the high points of each planet, and from this predict the rising of other bodies. He was also expected to foretell solstice, knowing the northing and southing of the sun, announcing all its wonders and appointing for them a time. He declares when they have occurred, the dates for celebrating the gods' feast days, and the exact relations of spirits and the gods of the pharaohs. Like most pre-industrial peoples, the Egyptians continuously struggled to impose order on the universe, viewing the sun itself as needing protection against those forces always lurking to disrupt the continuity of things. In a world characterized by disorder and frequent calamities of nature, religion joined forces with science. Its priests... Look, you can see these sun rays come out. It's just so beautiful. Egyptians, the family of Akhenaten offers sacrifice to Anu, the sun god. It's interesting, the sun rays. I love the sun rays because it's ray optics. Following the protection of people through ritual and cult, they created a body of anthropologic explanations to make up the workings of the cosmos. The sky was not an empty vault, but a goddess who each night conceived the sun, a early example of immaculate conception, in each morning gave him birth. even in the dead space that separates the heavens and the earth, was a god. In this universe, creation and existence were a product not of impersonal forces, but individual wills and actions. Various divinities of the Egyptians created an embodiment, a network of relationships at the center, which abasts the sun. Over time, their philosophy of creation became yet more complex. Atum, the creator, the pre-existing being in whom all existence was inherent and throughout whose self-realization or creation evolved, brought all matter out of himself. Creation was the result of nothing other than his masturbation, a notion to us extraordinary, even ridiculous, but for the Egyptians, a self-realization of Aten's own substance. Often Atum, who would change places with the sun and the stars, was his ultimate incarnation. At other times, he was the conscious void within which the sun first arose. The moment of orgasm was a useful way as any to describe the way in which the universe came into being. A cosmology that suggested the ancient Egyptians were, by several millennia, the first proponents of the Big Bang Theory. Oh, isn't that beautiful? So they said that everything began with the Big Bang. Isn't that beautiful? He could only get away with saying that here. Such beliefs, the Egyptian struggles towards scientific knowledge developed in parallel. In the early centuries, the Egyptians, like the Babylonians, never attained Lockyer's third stage. It would take millennia before the sun was studied solely to gain knowledge. But close by was a society that valued knowledge perhaps more than any other in history. Isn't that beautiful? I think that's a beautiful thing. I mean, it's a bit rich. You have to say it. You can only say it in a book like this, far from academic sensibility. He is true that having got knowledge and having people, you don't want people to want knowledge so much that they don't do it. You don't want to have people, you want to give people enough money that they don't quite have everything that they want, so they have to keep on going back to work. You want people to be educated, but not so much that they spend all their time to be educated. You want them to be, you know, satiated here. And so I would agree that our civilization is not all that much interested in knowledge. Thanks a lot for listening. That's next chapter. Next chapter is Enter the Greeks. Thanks a lot.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.